This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
8-hour live broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream, the 28th anniversary tribute to Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you, remote broadcast team. This week, KBOO members will receive the first wave of new membership cards powered by Supportland. Enjoy the enhanced new benefits. KBOO will be producing live, on-location broadcasts of the 2013 Illihi Monthly Lecture Series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It, making this valuable information available to the entire community. Tune in, turn on, and remember, we'll air Tuesday, January 29th at 6 p.m. Hear Sharon Wood Wortman share memories as a volunteer KBOO reporter in the 80s. If you have a story to share from KBOO's past, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the Weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
It's about time.
Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio for January 30th, 2013. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
I'm Joe Lino.
And I'm Joe Meyer.
We're going to keep things interesting and throw a variety of things at you today. Like usual, Joe Meyer's been following the Mohammed Mohammed trial closely, and we're going to have some of his observations on that.
And I'll be interviewing Elmira Rodriguez, who is a very integral part in the Occupy encampment and has been very active ever since. And tonight I'll be talking with her about the 1 Billion Rising movement coming up on February 14th.
And I've put together a special report on community resilience, which is a combination of three interviews. You'll hear from Alona Trogub and the Cascadia branch of the PSU Environmental Club. We'll hear from some of the activists who challenged wage theft that was occurring at a local food establishment. And we'll hear from our friend Piper regarding the Rainbow Family and their efforts at building community resilience.
So like usual, let's get to it.
The trial of the so-called Christmas tree bomber started January 11th, 2013 in the Marco Hatfield Courthouse at 1000 Southwest 3rd Street in downtown Portland. After more than 2 weeks of testimony, the government rested their case this past Monday, January 28th, and this special edition of the Police Piece recounts those 2 weeks. I'm your host, Joe Meyer. It was already evident from the opening arguments that the facts of the case are little disputed. On November 26, 2010, the day of the tree lighting ceremony, the defendant was driven by an undercover FBI agent in a white van containing an FBI-constructed fake bomb to Pioneer Square. He did indeed follow the FBI agent's instruction and connect wires in the back of the van. He was driven to another location by the FBI agent and, following the instructions of the FBI agent, did indeed dial the cell phone that he was told would detonate the fake bomb. When the defendant stepped out of the van, the FBI rushed in and arrested him. Since the defense is presenting entrapment, the government's case has two goals: to show that Muhammad was predisposed to commit the crime and that he was not unduly influenced to commit the crime by his FBI handlers. The first week of testimony was largely forensic. The first week of testimony was a largely The first week of testimony was largely a forensic look at the defendant's writings. He wrote articles for an online journal called Jihad Recollections and had email contacts with people in Yemen and viewed videos of Osama bin Laden calling for jihad. This evidence was presented to show predisposition of the defendant. The second week featured the government calling the two undercover FBI agents who had direct contact with the defendant. To protect the identity of these agents, the public was not allowed in court for this testimony and watched a video feed from a different room. These agents had Muhammad carry out several tasks, including renting a storage locker to construct the bomb, finding a good parking space at Pioneer Square, and viewing a test explosion. The government argued that these tasks showed that the defendant was actively participating and even taking initiative on the plan. On cross-examination, the defense countered that the instructions for the tasks were so specific that they showed no initiative, only compliance, and that the FBI was actively crafting evidence, always with an eye towards how things would look in front of a jury. The defense further hinted that the FBI had a tried-and-true recipe for building these cases, including what public defender Lisa Hay called the triad of evidentiary valuation: plan, justification, and long-time involvement. And indeed, the undercover agents continually hammered on these points, asking up to 8 times at a single interview, "So how long have you been thinking about this?" until they got the answer they wanted. Also interesting and revealing are the errors made by the FBI during this case. These include slips by undercover agents posing as Al-Qaeda operatives, including saying, "I feel like a kid before Christmas," and, "We don't want to support those Palestinians, Israelis. Since the outtakes are powerful evidence for the defense, another FBI error was leaving the tapes on after the defendant left, and these so-called outtakes played an important role. They showed the agents unfiltered and very different from how they appeared both in their undercover roles and in their roles as witnesses. On the stand, they kept saying that during the operation they were trying to give Muhammad a way out, and on the stand even managed to express sadness that he continued. While on the outtakes, they celebrated that the target took the bait and that it was too good to be true. A constant theme throughout the trial was discovery of evidence, or what evidence was allowed to be displayed to the jury, and almost every morning opened with 20 minutes of legal arguments. This happens before this jury is seated, and it's my understanding that the FBI planning meetings and debriefs will not be allowed. The so-called outtakes have an interesting status. If the undercover agents give testimony that factually conflicts what is on the outtake, then the defense is allowed to play the tape. Since the outtakes are powerful evidence for the defense, this has made for very exciting cross-examination, and the FBI witnesses have been flawless. The issue of missing FBI tapes at critical moments is also a regular theme.
Joe, you've been there for over 2 weeks now. You've been there for every minute of the trial and had a chance to do some interviews live on the news at KBOO. Thanks for encapsulating all that for us. What's some of the other aspects of the evidence presented so far that has really gotten your attention?
One thing I found interesting, Jimmy, was the kind of the siloing of information. The FBI within the Bureau seems to really care about how information is shared. For example, the first FBI contact with the defendant was by a guy named Jason Dodd, and his alias was, I believe, Bill Smith. He contacted Mohammed in January of 2010, had several email contacts with him, and he was the first one to suggest doing action in the U.S. That undercover operation failed. They stopped it. They started another one. That one failed, and when the third one started, the FBI agent was able to credibly say, oh, gee, I only met with him for 10 minutes, and after those 10 minutes, he already suggested doing action in the United States.
So the attempt to get Mohammed to detonate an explosive, this event is the result of three different attempts by the FBI to get Mohammed to do that?
That's correct. Actually, the FBI had contact with Mohammed even before that. When he was 17, he started joining chat rooms and so forth with people that the FBI had investigations open with. So the FBI knew about Mohammed even when he was 17. They claimed not to have been investigating him when he was 17. But as soon as he turned 18, they sicked a couple of agents on him with email contact. And my understanding is that the FBI does this fairly regularly. I call it phishing. They send out mass emails looking for someone to respond to it. Mohammed responded one time. He got on their list.
And were all three of these efforts originated out of the local Portland office?
The first one was out of Eugene for some reason. Bill Smith was out of Eugene, and he was just he's just a fisher.
But the other two were Portland office originated attempts to get him to...
I think the second one was out of San Francisco. There was Agent Chan who was involved in that. He was the case agent for a while out of San Francisco.
Where was Mohammed at this time when they were contacting him via email?
I think he was a student at OSU at this time. He was a freshman, 18 years old.
He was doing online chats with someone. The FBI became aware of him when he was around 17. And then during his college years, he had three separate attempts to get him to do this by three separate FBI field offices. And this was all while he was in Corvallis.
While he was in Corvallis, and the defense brought up the fact that he said no to the first two times, and the FBI would not take no for an answer.
And they blame it on lack of information sharing.
Exactly. The third FBI agent, Hussein, says, oh, I didn't know anything about that. The first agent, Bill Smith, wrote that he's a conflicted youth, religiously conflicted. He's using drugs and alcohol, easily manipulable. And the agent, Hussein, says, oh, I didn't know anything about that. I was just chatting with him. I came in cold.
Okay, sure. Earlier, we were talking before we started recording, and you were mentioning about a surfeit of agents to just do a surveillance of Mohammed.
That's right. The defense brought up the case of the test explosion, November 4th, 2010, somewhere outside of Corvallis. Two agents picked up Mohammed in the morning, drove him to a test site a few hours, I think, west of Corvallis. There were already seven FBI teams there, surveillance, security, explosive experts. They even had an airplane keeping track of Mohammed's location at all times. It was interesting that it came out in the defense. I think they were prepping him to blow up the real bomb. It was also a cell phone bomb. They showed Mohammed a fake bomb. They planted a real bomb some distance away. They gave Mohammed a cell phone to detonate. The agent Hussein started going into the God is great chant. The other agent, Youssef, is trying to import the significance of the event. And the defendant, who I believe is stoned out of his mind, just as he's dialing the phone, says to Youssef, oh, wow, you got a lot of gray hair. That's really interesting. And kind of grabs his head and looks at him, just not really interested in the explosive part of it.
And yet there was over a dozen FBI agents vigilantly making sure that this quote-unquote violent jihadist wasn't just going to all of a sudden take out two FBI agents who are armed and within arm's reach of him. And this guy is such a force to be reckoned with that he's so focused that he's paying attention to how many gray hairs one of the FBI agents has.
Yeah, I would say he's easily distracted.
We were also talking about some of the requirements, the evidentiary requirements that the defense was listing. They had to establish that Muhammad had been planning such events for a period of time. Tell me more about that again.
Well, what seems to be coming out during the trial is that the government has a sort of a paint-by-numbers approach to these kind of cases, where you have to have a certain amount of evidence to proceed to the next state. And public defender Hayes called this the triad of evidentiary valuation. And she mentioned plan. There has to be a plan to commit some kind of terrorist act. There has to be a justification. And there has to be an idea of how long you've been thinking about that. And in this case, the plan was to blow up Pioneer Square. The justification was Americans are killing Muslims, women, and children overseas. And I think Muhammad said he's been thinking about this since he was 15. And this comes out in the interviews where the FBI agents continually ask Muhammad these questions until he gives them the answer they want. The defense brought up that the FBI agents asked him 8 times in one interview, how long have you been thinking about that, and kept on hammering on him until they got the answer they wanted.
Was he giving them different answers, or was he just distracted and not answering the question at all?
Yeah, again, I think this was the August 19th meeting, which was the first meeting between Yusuf Hussein and the defendant all in the hotel room. The scene at that hotel really is very telling in my mind. The two men are walking around the defendant sitting on the floor surrounded by takeout cartons, stoned out of his mind, and basically directing him, alternately threatening him and praising him until they got the answers he wanted.
And it took him 8 attempts to get him to even say how long this fire had been burning in his belly to commit these acts.
That's right.
Sounds, again, like just a really focused individual here.
Was there any evidence about where Muhammad had got the marijuana that he was stoned out of his mind on?
Well, they presented text messages and email messages from his days at Corvallis, where he was buying and selling weed and using it. One text message was, I just got a gallon of vodka and a dub, LOL. Now, a dub I'd not heard of, but apparently that's a slang for marijuana.
If I understand correctly, the lingo of the kids nowadays that maybe a dub is $20 worth.
Okay.
But don't quote me on that.
Okay.
That's not a market quote price there.
Okay. So he was both buying and selling weed in Corvallis. And on the second meeting between these three, Yusuf Hussein and the defendant, on September 7th at the Marriott Hotel, towards the end of the meeting, Muhammad asked Agent Hussein, hey, man, you got something to burn? And Hussein said, by all means, go right ahead, which indicated to me that not only did the FBI know he was using marijuana, but they were also indeed supplying him with marijuana. Another interesting thing about these meetings was the very first meeting between Agent Yusuf and the defendant was not recorded. This is the famous case where the recorder failed. Interesting testimony came out about that when the government called FBI agent Mario Galindo to the stand. Agent Galindo had been with the FBI since 1998, started in narcotics, and then has been a tech agent in Portland since 2002. He was the surveillance specialist in charge of wiring up undercover agent Yusuf for that all-important first meeting on Friday, July 30th, 2010. Yusuf was equipped with a transmitter as well as a recording device. The transmitter allegedly worked, allowing the FBI agent Chan to listen in and take notes, and the recording device allegedly failed. Now, on direct examination by the prosecution, Agent Galindo testified that he had tested the recording device the day before and must have accidentally left the device on, draining the battery. He reported that he first learned that the recording device failed on the following Monday, August 2nd. However, upon cross-examination by public defender Steve Sadie, Agent Galindo seemed to modify the story. He testified that the recording device was actually turned off when he put it in the case on the evening of July 29th. This is after a pointed question by Mr. Sadie that, well, doesn't it have a little red indicator light? And didn't you look at that? And then he admitted, okay, it was turned off when I put it on. And then the FBI electronics specialist suggested that the recording device must have somehow turned itself on in transit while in its plastic case.
And they're also, by claiming this, we're also supposed to believe that the transmitted signal wasn't separately recorded?
The transmitted signal was only taken down by Agent Chan's notes.
Right.
That brings up another point. Public Defender Sadie also called into question the FBI timeline. Now, Agent Galindo knew that the recorder failed on the morning of August 2, 2010, and reported this immediately to his supervisor, while Agent Chan, who was listening in via the working transmitter, had testified earlier that he destroyed his notes on August 3rd because he didn't find out about the recorder failure until much later. Again, this idea of the FBI siloing information, you know, kind of a need-to-know basis, and they're able to craft kind of evidence after the fact. The story seems pretty damn incredulous, though.
Yeah, a siloing information between the agents that are working on the same case? That's absurd that they wouldn't be talking about the thing that they're working on together and how it's going in time for enough for this guy to save his notes.
Agent Chan says he took all of his notes and typed them into the report, so those are luckily saved. And as soon as he heard that the tape recorder failed, he rushed to the garbage bin, and lo and behold, the notes were already gone.
Oh, so we don't have any source document to go on whatsoever.
No original source.
Right.
No original source.
Anything else about the trial jump out at you?
Well, something that's kind of important, you know, this idea of entrapment. What is entrapment? And on the first or second day of the trial, the jury asked that to the judge. The jury can send notes to the judge. The jury sent a note saying, please give us a definition of entrapment. The judge thought about this for a day and came back and said, I want you to hear all the evidence, and I'll give you a definition of entrapment with your jury instructions after both sides have rested. And I think that's really going to be a critical, critical case. I think a simple definition of entrapment is conduct by a law enforcement agent inducing a person to commit an offense that the person would otherwise have been unlikely to commit. And by those standards, there's no way this kid could have put together this bomb. He had no idea how to do it. He was led by the hand every step of the way. However, the entrapment defense in the United States has evolved mainly through case law, and there's two competing tests known as the subjective and objective tests. The subjective test has to do with the defendant's state of mind. If the guy was predisposed to do it, that's enough. The objective test looks at the action of the government officials in terms of inducing it. Would this be something he already did? So if the judge gives kind of the first definition, only predisposition is enough, I'm not sure how the jury is going to react to that because of his jihadi writings. However, it's clear there's no way he could have put together a bomb by himself. So if the charge is trying to
having certain feelings, essentially. If he had certain feelings, then he's guilty.
It's a thought crime in that case. But the real crime he's charged with is attempting to detonate a bomb of mass destruction in the United States. And of course, it's hard to understand that even because the bomb never existed really. But still, that's what he's charged with, and that's what we're up against.
Okay. Well, that says a lot. Thanks for doing that, Joe, and thanks for sharing your observations on the trial of Mohammed, the infamous accused Christmas tree bomber from here in Portland, Oregon, who the defense is claiming has been entrapped and goaded into the actions that he took to quote-unquote detonate a non-unquote, a real fake bomb, a bomb that was fake. All right. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that it took three different agents to finally get him to agree to go along with this. Is it coming out? Are you getting any sense of how many agents in total were involved in this whole case? You mentioned before about the 14 people while they did the test bomb were... It seems like a lot of expense has been poured into this.
That's also been a constant theme by the defense. The judge is not really allowing it because I guess it's not pertinent to the case necessarily, but the defense keeps on bringing up the expense by the government. At the test bomb, they had an airplane and 20 agents or something. I was surprised to see some of the logs they showed. And just when he went to his mom's house, they had a dozen agents surveilling him. I guess they take turns walking past the house so as not to be detected. But one gets the feeling that the FBI has a certain budget for this kind of terrorism or anti-terrorism, and they have to spend that money.
To justify it and get the funding again for that amount.
Seems like it.
Come on.
Today we're speaking with Elmira Rodriguez, a longtime activist in the Occupy movement. Right now she's helping organize a Portland chapter of 1 Billion Rising to stop violence against women and girls. Hello, Elmira.
Hey, Joe.
So, why don't we start with you telling us what 1 Billion Rising is.
1 Billion Rising is a global campaign to demand the end to violence against women and girls. This is a global movement. Every continent in the world is rising. There are actions and movements happening all over the world. And 1 Billion Rising PDX is joining in with that movement.
Is there a history behind 1 Billion Rising?
Yeah, this is the first year that 1 Billion Rising has come up, but it's also a celebration of V-Day. This is the 15th anniversary of V-Day, and to commemorate the 15th anniversary of V-Day, they've decided to launch a global campaign called 1 Billion Rising. And you can easily find out more information about the history of V-Day and its connections with feminism by Googling it.
And V-Day, what's the date?
February 14th.
So Valentine's Day. First, on a global level, what do you see is going to happen?
We've been hooked up with the Facebook accounts of all the other 1 Billion Rising chapters around the world, and we're getting their updates on our Facebook feed. And, I mean, we're talking about countries that have, you know, never had a feminist movement are now rising. Women are rising. We're talking about women that are subject to genital mutilation. We're talking about women who are forced to work in slave factories. Women all over the world are rising.
And what can we expect out of Portland for V-Day?
So out of Portland, we are going to be gathering at Director's Park at 3 p.m. on February 14th, F-14. And at around 3:30, maybe 4 o'clock, we're going to be marching to a venue on a route that's yet to be determined. And our venue is going to be at the Pytheon building. And once we've gotten to our venue, about 4:30 or so, we're going to be having an afternoon and evening full of workshops, networking, breakout sessions, a banquet, videos, video viewings, things of that nature. Lots of organizations have signed on to this movement to be able to give workshops and really kind of just raise awareness about the social justice issues that they're working on in Portland. We are in collaboration with the Idle No More PDX movement. They're going to be coming down and representing the austerity measures that are threatening the VAWA Act. And if you don't know what the VAWA Act is, it's the Violence Against Women Act, which was actually killed on the floor precisely because it offers too much support for Native communities amongst other disenfranchised communities. And the VAWA Act specifically would allow perpetrators of violent crimes against women who commit these crimes on tribal lands to be prosecuted by tribal authorities. And right now, the tribal authorities don't really have the authority to do that, and neither do other authorities off of tribal lands. So it's this really murky area where pedophiles, rapists, abusers go on to tribal lands and commit these crimes, and there's no accountability for them. So they'll be there representing that.
And that was killed because it gave too much support?
Yeah, there's lots of information on our Facebook page about the VAWA Act, and you can research it, but one of the reasons that the GOP gave was it was too supportive of these communities. And, you know, it's all linked with the austerity measures. You know, this came right before the cliff, of course, and they were trying to make all these adjustments, and VAWA was one of them that got dropped. One of the workshops that we're going to be putting on is going to be hosted by State Senator Lori Mones Anderson. And she was the primary sponsor of House Bill 4077, which was a teen dating violence act. And it mandates that schools and educational institutions play a more active role in preventing and educating about teen dating violence. So we're going to be hosting a workshop on that. Woman Strength is going to be hosting holistic self-defense classes, as well as Girl Strength. So we're going to have two different workshops, one for women and one for girls, to be able to give them some more skills on defending themselves in situations of violence. So we're also working with the Sexual Assault Resource Center, and they're going to be coming down and talking about Portland's thriving human sex trafficking industry here in Portland. If nobody knows, Portland is the number two portal in the nation for human sex trafficking. So a lot of people don't know this. And so they're going to be coming out to raise awareness on that. There's a real lack of accountability within the Justice Department to confront and address the human sex trafficking issues, especially as it pertains to children. Which a lot of people don't know. It's not just adults that are caught in sex trafficking, but there's also children caught here. So, again, the second largest portal in the nation right here in Portland. We also got representatives from the Native Wellness Institute coming down to talk about the connections between rape of our women and the rape of our earth and trying to promote a community and a culture of healing for that. So they're going to be talking about that as well. So those are just a few of the organizations that we're working with that are going to be coming down to give workshops. So we've got a lead-up event happening on Sunday, February 10th, and this is going to be hosted at the Pythian Building in the NIA Dance Studios. You can find more information about that on our Facebook. If you go to our Facebook page, 1 Billion Rising PDX, and click on our events page, you'll have all the information there. You can join and share the event. The address is 918 Southwest Yamhill Street, Portland, Oregon. And this workshop is going to be held on the third and fourth floor. The facilitator of this workshop is Lainey Bergen. It goes from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And the primary intention of this workshop is to bring awareness to the individual intentions and themes around violence against women, working from the micro to the macro, allowing space for personal feelings and associations to rise and fall through moving, drawing, and witnessing. The secondary intention of this event is to set the tone for a mindful, attentive, and deliberate campaign on the collective level. So that's the lead-up event happening on February 10th.
Okay. You said that was a Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
So V-Day's on a Thursday.
Correct. A little bit more about the events happening on F-14. We'll also be having a meditation for 1 Billion Rising, expressive arts for 1 Billion Rising, and a sacred circle dance, a belly dancing workshop, Break the Chains dance for 1 Billion Rising. So there's a large dance component that's going to be, this is specifically why it's being hosted in the NIA Dance Studio.
I read something about a call for walkouts. What is that all about?
1 Billion Rising Global Campaign is calling for a strike dance rise, and it's got a strike component to it. They're asking, don't do whatever you were going to do that day. Instead, come out and rise. Come show some solidarity for the women of the world who are rising and, taking the option of violence toward women essentially off the table. So come out in solidarity with that and join in on the local movements. So we will be there at 3 p.m. We made it not so earlier in the day because we understand not everybody can take the whole day off. So we put it, in the afternoon. So if you have to take a half a day off even, to help contribute to the strike aspect of this event. So we have a few more organizing meetings left before F-14, and we are working really hard in the organizing teams, but of course we could always use some more help. So if you want to plug into this event and help organize it and make F-14 a real point in our cultural shift where violence against women is really no longer an option, please consider getting involved. We've got several opportunities all in organizing teams, all of them in desperate need of more energies and people to come in and take action items to make this day really great. So I will list a few of those here and ways to get involved. You can become part of the outreach team. We've got the dance team. We've got the rally and march team. We've got the flyer squad. And then the banquet and networking event organizing teams. So we've tried to kind of distribute the work up that way. Oh, and we've also got a food team. So, of course, there's a banquet associated with the event after the march and rally. So we're all needing help in all of those areas. Our organizing team is growing slowly over the weeks. We went from our very first meeting, where not a whole lot of people knew about it. Only 4 or 5 people were showing up to the meetings. And, it's slowly growing and gaining momentum. But we really need some more energy. So if you have time and a passion to help make this day really great, our next meeting is going to be happening on Monday. Actually, at 6:30 p.m. The address is 3319 Southeast Sherman Street, zip code 97214. And you can call me at 503-501-8699 for more information. Or you can visit our 1 Billion Rising PDX Facebook page and, again, click on the events page and it will be listed right there.
All right. And that's February 14th, V-Day. And you're also involved in something called Culture Mend. Is that true?
That's correct.
And what is that?
Coulterman started as a response to having been an activist for quite some time and really understanding that there are no resources for activists. You know, we try to take on the work of changing the world, and we're confronted by all these institutions that have self-defense mechanisms in them. You know, there's consequences for not assimilating to the culture. You know, you don't get paid for your work. Yeah, sometimes you are subject to police brutality and arrest even. So, I mean, there is just not a whole lot of help or validation for your work or resources. And it's really hard to be active in your community and spend your time in activism and also try to meet your life needs.
Get stuff done, yeah. Right.
You know, you got to pay the rent still. You got to have somewhere to live. Or without those things, you can't function as an activist. You're always just trying to meet your basic needs for shelter and survival. And I also found being an activist that there wasn't enough meeting spaces. You know, we wanted to have a meeting, and you know, we wanted to go to community centers which were going to charge us, or we, you know, our other option was to go to a coffee shop where we'd have to purchase things, and you know, not having any money, that didn't work out very well. So we decided to create Coulterman, and Coulterman is an activist collective. You know, everybody in the house is, you know, to be able to live there, it's required that you're engaged and involved in some sort of activism. And so we offer low-cost housing for activists so they can spend less time working, making money, and more time plugged into social movement buildings, growing their own food, you know, making their own clothes, things of that nature. And we also provide a community free space at which anybody who's hosting a workshop, you know, hosting a meditation, or anything that is aimed at changing our culture can reserve the space for free. And we work on donation base for that space. So if you have some donations to throw to it for the use of it, great. If you don't, please use it to do your work anyways. So those are the two resources that we offer to activists. And we started it in November. We've got a full house now, brimming, actually. And the community free space is quite active. So, you know, any night of the week you can hop in and there'll be a meeting or something going on.
And the address of that?
That's 3319 Southeast Sherman. And we've got a Facebook page, the Coulterman Facebook page. You can go on there. You can see a list of our events. You can email us at coulterman@riseup.net and, you know, get some more information or request to reserve the community free space or anything like that. Some of the things happening in the community free space are we've got a land seekers meeting. This is a group of people coming together to acquire land, essentially, for rural homesteading, skill trades, things of that nature. We've got a trade circle happening every fourth Sunday of the month where we really just offer a sacred space for people to bring their handmade, handcrafted items and to trade for other handcrafted items. And it's just it's kind of like a learning lab of how we can use these handmade goods as currency for other goods. So, you know, we decrease our dependency on the monetary system as well as on, you know, having to shop at a store and consume items that are produced. So that's really the goal of that.
Elmira Rodriguez, thank you for talking about 1 Billion Rising event coming up on B-Day. Appreciate you coming and joining us.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Much need for communities that recognize that they're not being served by the larger nation state to, you know, carve out their own autonomy and live in a way that makes sense to them. We have so many nations here already that are unrecognized, that are First Nations, that are the right. Indigenous nations of Cascadia. And it's important to pay tribute to their identity. And it's also important to respect the need for resilience.
Some of the other subjects that you touch on in the zine / resource guide, which I really like, is the local economics and your highlighting of the Bridgetown Bucks, Portland's newest local currency, which is due to debut any time now.
Yeah, I was sitting at home a couple of weeks ago, and one of my housemates who's involved with the local currency movement came in and slapped down some money on the table, and I looked at it and I said, wait a minute, Portland money? What's this? And it turned out to be the Bridgetown Bucks. And so Carl Mullen and other folks from the Transition Portland group have been meeting and are now rolling out these Bridgetown Bucks all over town, specifically to encourage localization in our economy and to support small, locally owned businesses. And so it's just regular currency. It's a system that has worked in other places, especially if you look at Ithaca, New York. They used to have the Ithaca dollar, and it has been in their community for about 10 years, and it's actually now fading out of use because what happened is the local currency created a web of relations within the community of locally sustained and supported businesses.
So they didn't need.
And so
they went beyond the need for a currency?
Exactly. The relationships had to replace the need for currency. And that you can find that in a lot of other places around the world. I have a friend from Brazil. I can't remember what part, but it's a very small village, probably, you know, a couple thousand people. And they all have ledger systems in their stores, and nobody uses money. They just, you know, say, oh, I'm taking this today. Okay, I'll write it in my ledger. And they just have a trust relationship. But money only exists because we don't trust each other. So if trust comes into the equation, then all of a sudden the need for money seems to fall away.
Okay, but we already have money here in Portland. I use it every day.
Right.
Why do we need a new money? We already have it here. So why do I need local currency? What's the deal with that?
Well, one of the reasons is because you can't use local currency at non-locally owned stores. So, for example, if you had somebody who had done some work at your house and you had local currency and you gave it to them, they couldn't go to Walmart and spend it on something that was made overseas. They would have to use that in a store that was locally owned. If they needed a whisk, they couldn't go to, you know, like a big name kitchen and bath store. They'd have to go to, say, for example, Mirador on Division and get a whisk there using the local currency.
Okay, so I think you're touching on something there. This currency can therefore not end up in China. So what?
I think the biggest impetus to use local currency is that it keeps money circulating in Portland.
Because, okay, so essentially, an economy. Mm-hmm. Everybody worries about the economy. But actually, a strong economy, so if you're in a growth economy, what that essentially means is that money is moving more and more. If you're in a recessive or depressed economy, that means, if it's recessive, that means that money is essentially holding steady in its movement. And if you're in a depressed economy, that means that money is slowing down and starting to stagnate. And it's the circulation of money, or conversely, which hopefully, like in the case of Ithaca, we'll get to, the circulation of goods. But it's that circulation that is what you're measuring when you're saying whether the economy is healthy or strong or weak, et cetera, et cetera. It's the money that's moving. Money that doesn't move is not money. And so with this local currency, if the money has to stay moving locally, then it doesn't bleed off somewhere else and perhaps stagnate. And so just through that process of bleeding off a little bit of money here, a little bit of money there, a little bit of money here, it can have a depressive effect on the local stimulation and exchange of goods, which got us into the situation with $30+ trillion hidden away in bank accounts that's controlled by somebody that we don't even know who it is. And what kind of damage could those guys do? But that's getting a little bit off track.
One of the biggest concerns in Cascadia right now is the idea that environmentalists are preventing people from getting jobs, and people who are wanting jobs are destroying the environment. It's this, you know, which one can we have? Can we have a healthy environment, or can we have jobs? And it's really important, I think, to step out of that dichotomy and realize that by having a local economy, by people filling niches in their own community, we don't have to destroy our environment to do so. And local currency, I think, can add a lot to that, because all of a sudden people can start, you know, raising chickens to sell to their neighbors, or, you know, being a professional slaughterer of roosters that people don't want anymore because it's illegal to have roosters in Portland.
And who wants to slaughter a rooster? So then you become the guy who slaughters the roosters.
Yeah, which, rooster slaughter guy.
You know, I don't know why you picked that, but let's go with it. But anyway.
It's a need. It's a total need in our community.
And it is a job, you're right, that nobody wants to do, because it's, you know, it's got to be just disgusting and really traumatic.
No, it's not disgusting. It's not traumatic if it's done right. I've done it before. I'd fill that niche if I wasn't filling other niches right now. So I'm just putting it out there that that job's available. And
she's applying to Portland at large as the up-and-coming rooster slaughterer.
No, not me. Somebody else.
Oh.
I'm looking. I'm putting a wanted ad out there.
Oh, I got you.
And actually, another thing that Craig Mullins talks about in that article is the Portland at localexchange.com. And so you can sign up there. You can post things that you're offering. You can see what other people are offering. And you basically have a point system where you can award people points for the trades they make with you. And there's no incentive to keep the money. And so all of a sudden, that what you were talking about with the circulating economy is happening at a very quick pace, because people are just really excited to use the points they have. They're not gaining anything by collecting these points. From the west side of the mountains and west to the waste, sweet waters connecting this land that I crave. Once called State of Jefferson and North Canada, remove these borders from home to Cascadia.
The restaurant started hiring people in July of 2012. That's when I was hired on. And prior to the restaurant building being even ready for a customer, we were required to go to meetings and were promised pay that was never received, and so on and so forth. The mistreatment started at the very beginning. It carried on for a few months. The restaurant started serving people, I believe, in September, if I'm remembering correctly. And people started being let go and frozen out, given no hours for no reason, until they were forced to quit and find other employment. That really started happening around October and November, which is when I quit Yaz. And a few weeks later, beginning of December, I was contacted by another former employee about going to the IWW and We Are Oregon. When I was working there, and very prior to quitting, I felt really like I was lacking any ability to defend myself, to get what was mine. They really kept people in the dark about their options and how to act. And it was a bad time for everyone involved before we were contacted by IWW and We Are Oregon. Occasionally we would talk about it, but there was also definitely an undercurrent of fear if anyone was maybe caught talking about how they were unhappy with how the restaurant was being run. They did face the possibility of losing their job.
Sounds to me as if you felt like any attempt to do anything about this would result in an individual punishment.
Yes, absolutely. It was definitely a fear of that. Not only, you know, just punishment, but just flat out losing your job.
What were you thinking as this was getting started, maybe when you got that first call that, hey, let's stand up for ourselves and we have these people who will stand with us? What was going through your mind when that was being presented to you?
I definitely felt a lot more hopeful about my position. It gave me something to focus on beyond just trying to find more employment after being frozen out by Yaz. Gave me hope that I would be able to do something rather than just sit down and take it like I feel many of the workers had been doing.
when you were kind of starting this process, did you guys expect things to go this quickly, Brianne?
We actually didn't expect for it to go as quickly as possible. I mean, we had an action plan set up that was going to last until February. But we had a lot of support from people within the IWW, people within We Are Oregon, and just community members in general who knew about what was going on. So we did have a lot of support. There were people, regardless of if they were organizing with the campaign itself, with the IWW, we had a lot of support from them. They showed up to a lot of the action. So it was pretty hopeful from the beginning, but at the same time, you always have to plan for the boss to not respond or to deny your request. So
I feel like things went as quickly as they did due to the fact that it was other people other than the supposed owner of the establishment who were in action, and they really didn't want to see the restaurant be slandered. I'm sure in their minds it would be slander rather than just telling the truth. So they really just wanted to get us to be silent as quickly as possible.
I also thought that the reason why it went so fast is because not only was there solidarity between the workers, everyone stuck together throughout the entire process. It was also solidarity based on the community outside of it. So I think that had a lot of weight in it and allowed it to move along a lot faster than if it was just the workers and they were all divided, working towards one goal separately versus everyone standing together.
Point of view, a resistance movement is only as capable of causing change as the strength of its component resilience movement. Something like Rainbow, where we're talking about, you know, gift economy and spiritual health and human value as opposed to financial value, and where we're talking about like direct democracy and consensus model process and those things that have grown out of it, it was a place for those seeds to be planted. And relationships were formed at Vortex that those relationships later went on to push the movement forward. I don't think that politics or political activism has ever been the, you know, cornerstone of the Rainbow family. It's definitely something that the family has engaged in. But the cornerstone of the family has always been a resilience movement. The idea of getting massive amounts of people to come together and identify as a whole. And then because they identify as a whole, to take care of each other. And what you get there is a gigantic skill set, a gigantic social network, you know, like pre-internet, actual real world social network of people that can help each other and provide for each other. And that is instrumental. You take just resistance and it's not going to last, because when you're putting resistance out there, you're coming up against, you know, a state that has become very draconian, and you're coming up against a culture that is very homogenized and very deeply ingrained in the American psyche. If you want to change that, you can't just throw energy in its face. You also have to have a power base to build from. And I think that is really what the family has brought to activism. Because simply put, 5 weeks in a park or a year in an office isn't going to change the way things are. We need years and years. And that's something else that the Rainbow family has taught me, at least.
Tell me some more about some of the underlying philosophy of the Rainbow and how you see that playing into creating that resilience.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's to say that there is a Rainbow philosophy is, that's true, but it can be misleading in that, you know, there's no core ideology that was put forth. You know, in the beginning, there were a few consensus that were agreed upon. Such as? The idea of the creation of an autonomous zone, the idea that everything would be horizontal, the idea that everything would be free, the idea that we would keep, that we would be peaceful and keep not only violence, but what we call aggro energy, you know, heavy drinking energy and, you know, emotional disagreement energy kind of out of the core of the camp. Over the years, like, the idea of even those simple consensus being tried on the ground and becoming tradition. But, you know, in as much as a body of traditions is an ideology or is a way of life, you know, that certainly does exist. The 40 years of history have taught us what the Rainbow Way is. And a lot of it did affect occupiers and the Occupy Portland camp and other Occupy encampments in a very deep way.
Those interviews are excerpted from extended interviews which I conducted with Ilona Trogub of the Cascadia branch of the PSU Environmental Club, the activists from We Are Oregon and the IWW, and Piper. All three of those interviews can be found in their full form at our Tumblr site, which is opdxradio.tumblr.com, where you'll also find links mentioned in the interviews.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Occupy Radio on KBOO. And as usual, we want to thank our engineer, Kurt Lauer.
We had some production assistance from Dalton Kupker. That was music from The Pretenders, Break Up the Concrete. We also heard Michael Franti with his tune, Yell Fire.